Well, in the neighborhood of 500 WKAR supporters have contributed to the public radio cause here at WKAR in the last week or so. We are in the neighborhood of $70,000 or so over that period of time. Many thanks if you have donated, and if you get to us with a donation by 7 p.m. tonight, you'll automatically be entered for a chance to win a night stay at Firekeepers Casino and Hotel in Battle Creek, a $250 value thanks to Firekeepers for their support of WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to our program. Two state water quality experts and a Flint utility official face criminal charges related to the Flint water crisis. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta reports.
Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette says the charges include misconduct and neglect of duty, tampering with evidence, and lying to cover up the lead contamination of the city's drinking water. Schuette says this is an ongoing investigation.
These charges are only the beginning, and there'll be more to come. That I can guarantee you.
You let the lower people get locked up so the big fish can still do what they do.
But Flint residents like Aaron Dunnigan say they want to see how high the investigation goes and who else gets charged for a water disaster that started while the city was under the control of state-appointed emergency managers. I'm Rick Pluta in Flint.
Now, after the charges were announced yesterday, Governor Snyder called them deeply troubling and extremely serious.
I've consistently said that a handful of bureaucrats had created a terrible situation in Flint from the beginning. If these accusations are correct, this would take it to a whole new level. And one of the things we clearly want to pursue is the truth. The citizens of Michigan deserve it. The citizens of Flint deserve it.
Now, the leader of Democrats in the State House, Tim Grimmel, has called on Governor Snyder to resign over his administration's handling of Flint's water emergency. Representative Grimmel joins us now to discuss yesterday's developments, his call for Governor Snyder to step down, and why Democrats have not pursued impeachment proceedings against the governor. Tim Grimmel, welcome back.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
Just briefly at the beginning here, share your thoughts about everything that transpired yesterday. We had the Attorney General announce the charges. We had the governor's response. Where is your head at on this right now?
Certainly everybody who is criminally culpable for what happened at Flint, regardless of what level of government they worked in, should be held accountable. And so I think that yesterday is a good start. It sounds like there are reasons to believe that all three of the individuals were criminally culpable for the problems associated with the Flint water supply. But I hope and I believe that Attorney General Schuette is going to continue to investigate others. As we've learned over the course of the past number of months, the governor's office certainly played a central role in not reacting promptly to this crisis. And the entire crisis really began because of decisions made by the state-appointed emergency manager. So the governor is right that this crisis was created by bureaucrats, but the bureaucrats primarily responsible for this were bureaucrats appointed by Governor Snyder himself.
Now, with the Attorney General's comments yesterday in mind that more charges will be announced, do you have any doubts about the particular people charged yesterday? And the reason I ask that is that, according to reports, Dr. Mark Edwards, who says he is pleased that the state has charged some people, but he's suggesting that the city employee in particular is likely not as culpable as the others. Are you deep enough into this to respond to that? Do you have doubts that resemble Dr. Mark Edwards on this?
Well, I don't know enough about the specific facts relating to these specific individuals, and I don't think those facts have been made public yet. So we'll have to wait and see exactly what Attorney General Schuette is alleging happened. But certainly I have doubts about how ultimately culpable the city employee was. Keep in mind that these decisions were made, both the decision to go to the Flint River water and the decision not to treat or properly treat the Flint River water, those were really made under the direction of the state-appointed emergency manager in the city, not by local elected officials. And we'll have to wait and see exactly whether city employees played a role in that. Obviously, the Attorney General is asserting that at least one did. We'll have to wait and see. So I'm going to reserve judgment until we see all the facts. But certainly, if local employees were culpable criminally in some way, they should be held accountable, too.
These doubts that Dr. Mark Edwards has involved the city employee, will identify his name. He's the city water plant operator, Michael Glasgow, just for the record. I'm curious if you've given any thought as to how high additional charges might go. Are you inclined to think that they will go significantly higher than the two DEQ officials charged yesterday?
Well, I think they need to go higher, and my hope is that Attorney General will vigorously pursue charges against everybody who is criminally culpable in this, no matter how high in state government they may go. We have known for some time now, with the release of a number of emails, that every high-ranking staff person in the governor's office knew about the serious problems associated with the Flint water going back to 2014 and did very little, if anything, to address the problems until a year later. That is very alarming. The administration has been far more focused on public relations positioning and spin than on actually fixing the problem in Flint. And even what the administration did start to do belatedly was only prompted once national media attention was focused on the challenge.
You've called on the governor to resign, which he says he will not do. Do you support efforts to recall Governor Snyder?
Well, I certainly think that the recall effort is warranted, as I've said before, for the very same reasons I think the governor should resign. And this is not a decision that I took lightly. It's not a decision that I jumped to. I had said all along before saying that the governor should resign that we first needed to find out what did the governor know and when did he know it. But once it became clear that this entire problem in Flint is really the outcome of a culture in his administration that is obsessed with spreadsheet totals and obsessed with numbers and dollars over the well-being of people. And once it became clear that these decisions were driven initially by the state-appointed emergency manager, and most importantly, once it became clear that all of Governor Snyder's top officials, his chief of staff, his top legal advisor, his top environmental advisor, knew about these problems going back to the fall of 2014 and did nothing to meaningfully address or solve the problems, I think that resignation is warranted. We need to make sure that we're holding government officials accountable when they fall down on the job. And Governor Snyder fell down on the job through his negligence and his indifference.
House Democratic Leader Tim Grimmel of Auburn Hills is our guest here today on Current State. We wanted to explore an option that's not got any coverage to speak of, and that is impeachment. Considering your position that the governor should resign, or put another way, is not fit for office, why have you and or other Democrats not attempted to impeach him or otherwise remove him from office?
Well, as you know, Mark, the Republicans control every branch of state government right now. They have a majority in the state House. They have a supermajority in the state Senate. They have a large majority on the state Supreme Court. And while there is a constitutional mechanism to impeach the governor, the reality is that the party in power in the legislature is never going to go along with that. And instead of spitting in the wind and spinning our wheels and wasting time in a divisive legislative fight that's not going to lead anywhere, our hope instead would be that the governor does the right thing, steps down from office, so that we as a state can start to put this behind us.
Wouldn't that have some symbolic significance, though?
When you say that, are you
pursuing impeachment?
Well, it may, but certainly I don't think that introducing an article of impeachment has any more symbolic significance than calling on the governor to resign. And we know that the Republican majority in the legislature is not going to allow that article of impeachment to go anywhere.
We got to wondering, if lawmakers were to pursue an effort to impeach the governor, how would it work? So we spoke with Steve Liedl. He's an attorney with the Dykema Gossett firm in Lansing. He served as chief legal counsel to then-Governor Jennifer Granholm. He investigated how impeachment would work when Granholm and others were looking for a way to remove former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick from office. Steve Liddle says a vote of a simple majority in the state house would send articles of impeachment to the Senate, much like it does on the federal level. Let's listen to that explanation.
If a house were to direct an impeachment against the governor or any other public elected official, the Constitution requires a trial to be conducted. If the impeachment involves the governor, the lieutenant governor, the chief justice of the Michigan Supreme Court is required to preside. And it requires a two-thirds vote of senators elected and serving to convict an elected official under the impeachment clause.
So with that procedural kind of question clarified here, I guess my question for you is, do you imagine circumstances related to the Flint water crisis that may yet rise to that level?
Well, it's certainly possible. At a minimum, as I said earlier, we know that going back to 2014, almost a full year before the governor acknowledges that he knew about the serious problems associated with the Flint water, that everybody around the governor knew. Emails clearly demonstrate that. Again, his chief of staff, his right-hand man, his top legal advisor, his top environmental advisor. So either the governor is lying when he says that he didn't know until nearly a year later, or if he in fact didn't know when everybody around him knew, he is the worst manager in the state's history. And either way, he needs to resign and step down because ultimately he has failed in his most basic function and in government's most basic obligation, which is keeping people safe.
It's been 6 years since your party enjoyed a majority in the state house, but Adam Zemke, your party's campaign chair in the house, told MLive this week, "We're in it to win it this fall. You need to flip 9 seats. Would your thoughts about pursuing impeachment change if you were successful in that quest?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that even with a Democratic majority in the state house, we could certainly initiate impeachment proceedings, but the Senate would still ultimately be the decision maker when it comes to expulsion from office. And the Senate's not up for election this year. The Republicans are still going to have a two-thirds majority in the Senate for the following 2 years. So certainly it would give us some reason to consider it, especially depending on what comes out of these criminal investigations. But it's still important to recognize that even with a democratically controlled state house, Republicans would control the Senate.
How do you put your chances, though, at retaking the House this fall?
Our chances are good. We, as you know and just said, we need to pick up 9 seats. That is very doable. If you look at the past 5 or 6 state house elections, that's very much in the average of the swing of seats that we've seen between parties in terms of pickup seats. And we've got a lot of factors in our favor this year. Certainly, it's a presidential year. We know turnout will be good. Most of our targeted districts are open seats because Republicans and targeted seats are all being term limited out of office this year. But third and most importantly, people in the state of Michigan are fed up with the status quo. They're fed up with the establishment. They're fed up with the lack of transparency and accountability in politics. And they are looking for change.
How much does the Flint water crisis play in that? Well, does that end up improving your chances significantly of retaking the House?
I think that there are a lot of factors that go into people being fed up with the status quo of state government. And certainly the Flint tragedy underscores some of the problems in state government, particularly the lack of transparency and accountability. But the problems go way beyond the Flint water crisis.
31 House Republicans are calling for the elimination of the Michigan Board of Education. They'd also eliminate the position of state superintendent, who's appointed by the board. Democrats currently hold 6 of the 8 seats on the board. What do you make of this move?
Well, this apparently has been prompted by the State Board of Education's concerns about the bullying of lesbian and gay students and their efforts to explore ways to try to reduce that bullying and to try to ensure that schools have a welcoming environment for all students. And frankly, it's alarming and shameful that Republican legislators would react to the State Board of Education's concern for the LGBT students in schools by wanting to strip the State Board of Education of its basic functions and powers.
Are you following particular races enough that I could ask you about one of them this fall for the State House?
Sure.
There is, and the reason I ask here, there's one contest looming in the Lansing area that I'd really like to ask you about, the 71st, involving Eaton County. Republican Tom Barrett won the seat last time by only 148 votes. You've got a Democrat in the race in November, Teresa Abbott, facing Barrett, who's held the seat before. Is that a scenario that where you think your Democrat, Teresa Abbott, will prevail?
We do. I'm very confident that Teresa will win that race. This is a rematch of the 2014 election where she lost very, very narrowly, as you indicated. Keep in mind that when she was first elected in 2012, she beat an incumbent Republican. She has the ability to do that. And the biggest problem that we as Democrats faced in 2014 was very low turnout. In a presidential year, we're not going to have those problems in that seat. And Teresa has a great track record. She's very well known. She's very well respected. She did a great job and a great, great work in the legislature while she was in the state legislature in 2013 and 2014. And a lot of her constituents are looking back at those days and saying they wish they had a great state representative like Teresa back in office.
I'd like to ask you about the presidential race, too. I mean, we've got a scenario where Hillary Clinton will probably get the nomination, but recently we've seen a real surge of support for Bernie Sanders as well. What do you make of the national scene right now on the Democratic side?
Yeah, well, I think actually on both sides, we're seeing some real dissatisfaction with the establishment and the status quo. I think that largely explains Bernie Sanders' popularity. I think it also, to a certain extent, explains Donald Trump's popularity. I think they're viewed as anti-establishment figures. And I can understand people's disappointment and frustration with the establishment. I think that's very justified. I also think that it needs to be focused in a way, that frustration, that is constructive. And that's why I've endorsed Hillary Clinton. I think that she is a candidate who has a proven track record of getting things done. And we need a person in the presidency who can work and actually accomplish things. I'll also note that I think a lot of the frustration is about the lack of transparency and accountability in politics and the huge influence that money play in politics. I think some of the appeal of both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is a very justified desire to see candidates who are not dependent on special interest money. And we have been pushing for more accountability, more transparency in state government. We've been saying that we need to expand the Freedom of Information Act to apply to the governor's office and the legislature. This is long overdue. The state of Michigan is one of only two states in the entire country that exempt the governor's office and the legislature from the Freedom of Information Act.
Tim Grimmel leads Michigan Democrats in the state house at the state capitol. Tim Grimmel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, how do we improve the cities and towns we live in? How do we make those spaces richer and more rewarding? We'll consider those intriguing questions with one of the country's foremost placemaking experts. Peter Kageyama comes to us here live from Studio S just before a visit here to East Lansing. That's on the way. Maestro Stephen Osmond has led the Jackson Symphony Orchestra for nearly four decades, one of the longest ever tenures for an American ensemble. But in April of 2015, the announcement came that Maestro Osmond was ready to step down from the podium, and a long search for a replacement began. That search is now over with the announcement of Dr. Matthew Aubin as the music director designate of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra. Current State's Jamie Paisley recently met with Dr. Aubin to get to know this new face to the Michigan classical music scene.
I'm Matthew Aubin. I'm from the East Coast originally, from Connecticut. And I am the music director designate of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra.
And congratulations for that as well.
Thank you so much.
But you've been in Jackson before, because I know you also performed with the Jackson Symphony. You're a horn player, and that's not the only Michigan band that you've been with either.
Right. I've been a sub with the Traverse City Symphony, and I've been in Jackson since August. My wife, Michelle, is an orthopedic surgeon who specializes in hand surgery, and she took her first job out of residency here, and we moved, and it's been a really great decision.
So if she's a hand surgeon, is she giving you pointers on your conducting technique?
Not exactly, but she does see a little potential in getting some new clients from the people I work with, actually. Yeah, she loves it here, and she actually has worked on quite a few musicians' injuries, flutists, violinists. She does a lot of carpal tunnel and things like that.
We briefly touched on it, but your main instrument is horn. What made you make that transition from horn to the conducting realm?
Well, I was a big marching band person in high school and did, I guess at first, I just conducted along to things like John Williams movie scores in the car. You know, when my father and I would go to, he would drive me for like an hour one way to my youth symphony rehearsal, and we'd listen to different music, and I just conducted along. And as a high school senior, going into my senior year of high school, they had drum major auditions, and I wasn't going to try out because I was a little shy. And somebody told the band director, you know, Matt is interested. And he pulled me in and basically made me try out. And it went really well. And those were my first conducting experiences. And since then, I've just fallen in love with what you have the ability to do on the podium, as opposed to what you can do on your individual instrument.
So last week was the announcement that you became music director designate, and because you never get time to rest on your laurels, immediately after you had a concert this past weekend in New York City with another organization, you're going to, I assume, continue that relationship with the Chelsea Symphony, right?
Yes, yeah. The Chelsea Symphony is a really unique organization that I joined in its third season, and we're now in our 10th year of existence, celebrating our 10-year anniversary. The orchestra is comprised of musicians that earn benefits to conduct or have a composition premiered or play a solo with the orchestra by playing other services with the orchestra. So you put in your time and then you get to be featured. So for instance, this last weekend, we did three different Mozart pieces. And then we also featured a flautist playing the Kent Kennan Night Soliloquy and the Howard Hanson Serenade for harp and strings, flute, harp, and strings. So we get to really explore a variety of repertoire, and we feature each other. And so the vibe within the orchestra is very supportive. And the level of the orchestra is very high because everybody's taking turns playing and conducting. So I conducted the second half of this concert, and it was the New York City premiere of Caroline Shaw's Entr'acte. She is a young composer who just won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago, youngest Pulitzer Prize winner. She's in her early 30s. And then we contrasted that with the Pulcinella Suite by Igor Stravinsky.
We're speaking with Dr. Matthew Aubin, music director designate of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra, who was recently named to that post and will be taking the reins from the Jackson Symphony's longtime maestro, Stephen Osmond.
You've been now named music director. Have you been formulating the next season? Because I know we're in the era right now where people are starting to announce their seasons.
Yes, yeah, yeah. In fact, Steve and I have met, and I'm not sure I want to announce specific ideas yet, but I will say that when I consider programming, there's a few things that I keep in mind, one of which is I want there to be variety throughout the season. I want different people to come in for different reasons. I think it's really important to feature soloists that are not just technical wizards at their instrument, but are also good at conveying why music is important and can interact with audience members. I like to include one chestnut, one warhorse, something that everybody's going to know when they come into the concert. So let's say I do something that's a lesser known American work on a second half. Maybe I contrast that with a piano concerto like the Grieg Piano Concerto, which is really well loved on the first half. And then I tend that for me, formulating a theme is a really great idea for each concert. And with the Chelsea Symphony, we actually have traditionally themed our seasons. So next year with that orchestra, we haven't titled it yet, but it's essentially going to be Coming to America, where we feature works by different composers that have either visited America in a substantial way or also emigrated to America. So you have people like Stravinsky, Rachmaninoff in that immigrant category, Hindemith. But then you also have people like Dvorak. And I was actually, right before you came, doing some research and just found this out. I wish I had known this earlier, but I know it now, which is that Tchaikovsky came to America in 1891 and was conducted on the first concerts at Carnegie Hall. So I'm thinking now that may be a direction I want to go, kind of find a way to include Tchaikovsky in with some of those 20th century guys.
Lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about an involvement that you've had with a certain television series as well.
Well, right. It's interesting. In New York with the Chelsea Symphony, because we are a younger group and we're, I think, known for putting on high-quality performances, every once in a while we get cold-called by these random people. And I've just learned that it's a good idea to follow up with whatever cold call you get. So years ago, we did a tour with Clay Aiken, and we've done backup to the Irish tenors and things like that. So this one was for a television show that Amazon, which is trying to do what Netflix is doing with their original programming, they wanted to do a television show based on the book Mozart in the Jungle by Blair Tyndall. And they needed background musicians, and they needed coaches for some of the actors to learn how to look like they're playing the oboe or the cello. And they also, once on set, just needed some help with, okay, we need to put some bowings in the music, otherwise we're not going to all look the same. We can't just seat all the woodwinds in one row. We need to seat them in a block like this to look accurate. So I've served as a consultant, hiring musicians, hiring coaches, answering questions. I've appeared on camera in the background, and the television show won the Golden Globe, but we anticipate that we know it's been renewed for a third season, and who knows, according to the storyline, how or if we'll be involved again, but we hope we are. Yeah, it's just been a lot of fun. It's fun learning about that side of things. But we don't actually play on camera. We're faking to a recording. So I hate to let the cat out of the bag.
Dr. Matthew Aubin, music director designate of the Jackson Symphony, congrats. And thanks also for kind of letting us get to know you a bit.
You're welcome. Thank you.
As the weeks and months roll on, I'm sure we'll see more details about this transition period for Dr. Matthew Aubin. That information can certainly be found online at jacksonsymphony.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, tomorrow, after months of hard work, MSU students will unveil the university's first tiny house. We get a behind-the-scenes tour of Sparty's Cabin with Tiffany Pupa, the MSU senior who spearheaded the project. That and more after the break. Hope you can join us for Pop-Up Stories tonight, our live first-person storytelling event. Will happen at 6 p.m. tonight at Scene Metro Space in downtown East Lansing. The theme for our storytellers is Fools Rush In, 6 to 7:30 tonight in downtown East L.A. We hope you can join us. Is there a city you love? If so, why? What makes it special? How could it be more special? Those are the kinds of questions East Lansing city officials will be asking tomorrow. They're inviting residents to brainstorm at a Love EL workshop with our next guest. Peter Kageyama is a placemaking and community development expert and a lover of cities. He's the author of two books, For the Love of Cities and its follow-up, Love Where You Live. Shanna Dreheim of the East Lansing City Council also joins us. Ms. Dreheim is involved in community development issues and placemaking as a policy consultant with Lansing's Public Sector Consultants. Peter Kageyama, Shanna Dreheim, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Peter, your focus appears to be grassroots change as opposed to the actions of a city council, for example. How did you become such an advocate? And you need both. I know you're going to say that, but how did you become such an advocate for the notion of grassroots change?
I think it has its origins here in Michigan.
Really?
Yeah, in 2007, I had the opportunity to tour around Michigan courtesy of MISHDA. I was doing some work with them. I was friends with them. And I saw some great stuff happening, especially in Detroit. And it seemed like there were these people who were doing amazing things for that city. This was before Detroit became kind of chic in terms of this particular story. This mm-hmm. was still when Detroit, it's a dying city. And they were doing amazing stuff. And I realized, wow, these people love this place. And that matters. Mm-hmm. And so I started seeing more and more of that. And obviously, this is a recurring theme in a lot of Rust Belt cities and certainly here in Michigan. So I give a lot of props to Michigan mm-hmm. and Detroit for helping start that.
Is grassroots change more likely in a university community?
I think it's certainly creative solutions, I think, are more likely in a university community. I think, university college towns tend to have this great mix of old ideas, new people, money, creativity, just lots of stuff happening. And that's a good formula for coming up with certainly more creative solutions.
One East Lansing placemaking effort that I'm sure will come up tomorrow at tomorrow's Love EL session, which, by the way, is from 4 till 7:30 at the Marriott Hotel University Place. But one effort will involve the artists' alleys mm-hmm. that have taken shape in recent months. Shanna Dreheim, where are these artists' alleys in downtown East Lansing, and what do people find there?
So we are in the process of redoing these two alleys. One is in the alley kind of between LS Techo and the new Fieldhouse restaurant bar there. And the other one is in the alleyway behind the surface parking lot right there in downtown.
Okay.
And we are working to do some very small scale but wonderful transformation of those with art and lighting and plantings and just some features that make those alleys, which are right now just plain kind of ugly alleys, and make them into really great spaces. And we're doing a sort of a multi-generational project with that, working with the middle school students and the seniors to design the mosaic and the mural that's going to go in the alley kind of by the LS Techo site, which is just a great way to transform, that space.
Peter Kageyama, what difference can projects like this make?
They make a big difference. Most of our citizens were thinking about the most functional kinds of things. Alleys should be, they should be relatively clean, they should be safe, they should be pothole free. But when we add something to the mix, when we add beauty, art, great design, we realize it's like, hey, this is cool. This has, this makes us feel better than merely a functional and safe sort of alley. So I think that sometimes we don't even recognize the importance of this until we've actually experienced it. And you walk down that alley and go, hey, this is actually really, this feels good. So I think our citizens sometimes need to be, you have to see it and to really feel it.
How do you get residents who may not naturally think about improving where they live to actually start thinking about it? How do you spread a sense of, let's say, civic creativity and placemaking mm-hmm. among the residents of a city?
Well, part of that is what we're going to try to do with the workshop tomorrow.
Right.
Because most citizens believe that city building is all big stuff, roads and bridges and schools and things like that. Most citizens don't believe that city building can be something like a little dog park or a community garden or a backyard festival that they do for their own amusement. That's city building, and it has value. And I think we need to get people to recognize that, that they can contribute something to the conversation.
You, Shanna, you took the plunge and got elected to city council last November, so you have a particular role in community development and placemaking. Do you feel that the city council is sufficiently aware as a body, as a group? Do you think there is sufficient awareness among the members about the notion of placemaking? Does everyone share the gospel to some extent?
Well, I think that's probably growing as everybody gets into that role and we all look at it a little bit differently. But yeah, I think across all five of us, we all believe in, the things that make our city strong, those assets and attributes, and that small can be a big big part of that. So maybe to varying degrees, but certainly in terms of the gospel and the theory behind it, absolutely, I think that's shared.
Peter Kagiyama, aren't the places that arguably need placemaking the most apt to have a lot less grassroots participation? Poor cities, for example, where basic needs are just a whole lot more pressing?
Yeah. Placemaking is one of those things that, again, every place could be better. And certainly the most challenged places probably need the most love and attention. And sometimes they struggle to meet that sort of minimum threshold standard of being functional and safe. But that's not an excuse to not address things, again, like beauty and art in places. So even in the most challenged, you know, areas of cities, even in a place like, let's say, Flint, right now. And some people might say, why would you think about doing something artistic in Flint right now?
You've anticipated one of my questions here. Well, what do you do with a place like Flint?
Well, I don't have a solution to how to fix the water system. You know, this is a generational problem that your state is going to be
facing.
But
there is a role for placemaking.
But there absolutely is a role in placemaking right now, because I think right now what people need is they need to feel somehow feel good about their community, even if it's in a small way, a smile, something that makes them see a light at the end of the tunnel that reminds them, saying, wait, despite all of this trouble, there is something that I still love about this place. And that is renewing. And that is important to the psyche of these people, and which is probably the most thing, the thing that's probably, you know, other than their physical health, it's probably the most damage, is they don't believe in their city anymore.
Peter Kagiyama is a placemaking and community development expert. He is the author of two books, For the Love of Cities and Love Where You Live. He's in town for a special Love EL workshop scheduled for tomorrow at the Marriott Hotel University Place, 4 till 7:30 p.m. Shanna Draheim of the East Lansing City Council also joins us. One more question for you, Peter. You travel all over. You see placemaking efforts getting proposed and taking shape. Give us the best example of placemaking that you've heard or seen recently. One that maybe might make a skeptic stop and think, hey, there's something to this.
Saw a really good example just like a week ago in Baltimore. And there was this really ugly sort of viaduct, a little a tunnel, you know, in the middle of the city. And I saw pictures of it from before, and it was kind of scary. I mean, it's the kind of thing, it's like, you know, you wouldn't want to walk underneath of that.
Yeah.
So they added LED lights that they can then program. They're different colors, seasonal. You know, if the Ravens win, it's all purple or something like that. And it was a big change. And it wasn't, you know, a relatively small amount of money, but it just has one of the impact of that is, you know, is incredibly important. It actually connected two neighborhoods that wouldn't have been, that you wouldn't really want to walk between, you know, especially after dark. But all of a sudden now this is inviting, and this actually seems to draw us in and actually encourages us to maybe walk through this and sort of explore. So something that small. I mean, I see good stuff all the time, but that was just one sort of popped in my head when you're mentioning that.
Sure. Doesn't development in the more traditional sense, and you touched on this earlier, Peter, doesn't traditional development, hotels, parking lots, mixed-use developments, guys in limos, you know, making it all happen, doesn't that still play a really big role in placemaking? We're seeing Red Cedar Renaissance here, mm-hmm. about to take shape, yeah. in East Lansing. That is a big,
absolutely.
Project.
Absolutely.
How do you juggle the we need both. Would you agree with Peter that we need the kind of the top-down approach,
absolutely.
As well as the grassroots approach?
Absolutely. We absolutely need both. There's a place for both. And they're not mutually, not only do we need both, they're not mutually exclusive. We should be building in placemaking components to any large development that's happening. So things as simple as making sure that you are creating buildings that are aesthetically pleasing, that have benches out front where people might want to gather, or, you know, things like that, that create spaces that people want to be and feel pride in. So absolutely, you need both.
We have less than a minute, but I don't want you to get out of here, Shanna, before I ask you about East Lansing's central development issue, mm-hmm. I think, and that's the old bank,
yeah.
building and the impasse over what to do with it. What's new there? What, if anything, can you share with us about that?
Well, there are new owners of that building, and we were talking just before this that we're feeling optimistic for the first time in a long time, that we have some new owners who really want to do some creative things there, and I think are moving ahead in some of that planning. There are a couple legal hurdles for them to still get through, but I think we're going to start to see some plans coming in for that and some developments on that front over the next year for sure. And so I think lots of great ideas being generated that are very in line with some of the placemaking things, creating mixed use, things that people want to, you know, places people want to be, hotels, restaurants, things like that. So I'm feeling optimistic.
We want to thank both of you for joining us today. Shanna Draheim is a member of the East Lansing City Council. Peter Kageyama is a Florida resident, but a placemaking community development expert and travels all over. He's in town for a Love EL workshop tomorrow at the Marriott Hotel University Place starting at 4 o'clock. Enjoy your visit. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Well, speaking of placemaking, 177 square feet does indeed constitute a place. But how big or how small does that space need to be? I mean, we're talking about actually the size of MSU's first student-built tiny house. After months of planning and building, Sparty's Cabin will get its official ribbon cutting tomorrow, just in time for Earth Day. Current state producer April Van Buren had a chance to talk to some of the students behind the project. April, do you think you could ever live in just 177 square feet?
You know, Mark, I think that might be enough room for my shoes.
Okay.
Probably not. But there are more and more people who are adopting the tiny house lifestyle. And I talked to Tiffany Pupa, who spearheaded MSU's first tiny house project, about why she thinks small living is having a big moment.
We're going to have a full porch on the front, so two people can hang out with their cup of coffee. And then our door is centered right in the middle. So you'll walk in, and we have this really large great room. That's where it's going to be your living room, your dining room, whatever you need it to be that day. Then in the back corner, we have the kitchen. It has an L-shaped countertop. It's very spacious. And then in this back left corner is the bathroom. So it has a shower and the composting toilet. Above the bathroom and the kitchen, we have our loft, which is, I think it's about 80 square feet. So it can have a queen size bed. And we have a lot of windows in the space. So I think we have, you know, at least 5-6 on the first floor, some on the top, and then even the loft has its own windowed area. And then there's also a storage loft on the front side. It'll have a lot of natural light. We're going to paint, you know, the inside white to let that light bounce around, make it seem bigger. And we really want the person inside to be able to connect with the outdoors. So just having these views to nature.
Always watch your fingers.
My name is Tiffany Pupa, and I'm a senior interior design student at Michigan State University. And the tiny house project is how I'm wrapping up my senior year, going out with a bang.
So this is kind of your last hurrah as a senior. Tell me a little bit about where this idea came from.
I'm in a student group called USGBC Students. That's United States Green Building Council. So we're just a student chapter. But every year, the chapters in the region get together, and we spend the day learning about sustainable topics. And there's one group that toured a tiny house, and it was very well received and very interesting. So when we were driving back from Cincinnati to Lansing, I was thinking about it, and I just couldn't stop. There was something about it that really stuck with me. And then I was thinking how we're from the School of Planning, Design, and Construction, and we could totally pull it off. We could build one of these things. So I emailed Dr. Crawford, the associate director of SPDC, that night, and it turned out she had just started working on a tiny house project with some other students, just kind of exploring how that would work in a community. She said, this is a wonderful idea, let's do some research. So from that moment on, I started researching just about how can you build one of these things, and how can you get this many people, so you have about 200 students working on this, to interact with the house and have a meaningful experience with it.
And so tell me a little bit about the design process when you're planning what this tiny house is going to look like. What did you want to include? What did you want it to look like?
Well, we went to a 3-day workshop, so there was a group of 4 students that went, and there we learned just some basic design things, like, you know, symmetry, what do you want it to look like, color schemes. That was just a small portion of it, and then we learned really what are the restraints. These are the things that we didn't know before. So we learned about the weight limits. So Some people like to see reclaimed wood on their tiny houses, the outside, and it looks really beautiful, but it weighs a lot. And if your trailer weighs too much, then your truck won't be able to pull it. You'll have to get a bigger truck. So we wanted to avoid that. And then also, you know, this house is going to be moving. It's inevitable. You know, even if we're just getting it to the site of whoever eventually owns it, it has to be able to withstand the different forces that will be on it on the highway, and it needs to be able to have some flex and give. So we weren't allowed to use things such as tile or things that could kind of come apart through moving. So that brought us down to like what's really going to be reasonable and rational to use in this house. And we're partnering with MSU Shadows Collection. It's a student group. So normally on campus when there's construction, these trees would be burned or chipped to mulch. But this group goes in and they salvage these trees, turn them into lumber, and then they use that to create a product, whether that's a cutting board or a wine stopper, table, etc. So they're doing our countertops, our ladder, and our shelves.
And so was that an important part of this house, was including sort of sustainable reused materials?
Yes, it was. So other sustainable products that we're using cellulose insulation as opposed to a foam or other solution that would possibly leach VOCs or toxins into the air. We're having a compost toilet. And everywhere we can, we're choosing our materials based off of the sustainability.
I'm talking to Tiffany Pupa. She's a senior interior design student in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at MSU. We're talking about the tiny house project that she conceptualized and is working on for kind of her last hurrah as a senior. How did you first get interested in sustainable design?
I've always been interested in sustainability and design. My mom is an interior designer and a homemaker, and she's also very frugal. So we're always been, you know, creating projects at home and reusing whatever we can. That's where my introduction to sustainability began. Then in high school, I was in AP Environmental Science, and I was thinking that I wanted to be a environmental engineer, you know, maybe work for the EPA, and that's where my mind was, but I always had this love of art. And so my teacher gave me a project to design a home to be as sustainable as possible. And it was a small assignment. It was really supposed to just take a day to do research, but I took a lot more time than that, and I got really into it. And I remember being mind blown. About that carpeting. I couldn't believe that carpet, some of them can have release VOCs, and I couldn't believe that we're gluing down this carpet with adhesives that have formaldehyde and all these toxins in them. And then I found out that carpet could potentially even clean the air that we're in. And I just started wondering, how does this impact, especially in healthcare? So that was my first kind of connection between design and sustainability. On a human level, and from that I just got obsessed, switched my major, decided to go to MSU, and I took off from there.
And one of the really cool parts of the project, other than, you know, the tiny house itself, which is pretty cool, is what's going to happen after it's finished. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So when it's completely finished, and once we have used it to educate the community and, you know, maximize our use with it, we're going to auction the home through Surplus. And once, you know, that process is finished, we're going to take those proceeds, maintain a seed fund for the students to be able to do projects like this again in the future, and then we'll donate the rest of the funds to charity. We have not identified one quite yet, but we're looking at something revolving around housing, whether that's homelessness or abused women and children centers that provide housing for people who need it immediately and who need a safe home.
What do you think it is? I mean, I think tiny houses have sort of captured people's imaginations recently. I think House Hunters even has a House Hunters tiny house now, a tiny house edition now on HGTV. What do you think it is about tiny houses that are having a moment right now?
I think it can speak to a lot of what people want. So the tiny house is a really supportive element to a minimalist lifestyle. There's something about going out and capturing your adventure and living off of experiences rather than materials. So I think it really captures people who are looking for things like that. But then also I've noticed that it's very popular with the millennial generation. Having something to own but still being able to work in a community. So a lot of times tiny houses will kind of form a community, and maybe they'll have, you know, shared use facilities that they all use, such as gardens or a pool or a gym or whatever that may be. Then it's also attractive to other generations, for those who want to, you know, downsize, a lot of retirees or even parents who want to move closer to their children after they've moved out. They're finding that this is a really great way to support that.
Tiffany Puba is a senior in interior design in the School of Planning, Design, and Construction at MSU. We've been talking about the tiny house that they are building in the MSU Surplus Center right now. Tiffany, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you very much for letting me talk about our project.
And if you want to get a taste of the tiny house movement, the ribbon cutting for Sparty's Cabin will take place at the Breslin Center tomorrow morning from 9 to 11 a.m. That's our show for today. Don't forget pop-up stories tonight. We'll be looking for you at East Lansing Scene Metro Space at 6. The theme is Fools Rush In. We bring you an Earth Day special tomorrow from PRX's Climate One series. The segment explores the future of transportation and, in particular, personal automobiles in the United States. We say goodbye to a highly valued employee today. It's April Van Buren's last day directing. Not only does April get a lot of work done and make a sizable contribution to our program, her work is consistently high quality. We couldn't have asked for more in an employee. April, you will be missed. Best of luck. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.